of results from the present run. And then I will draw some conclusions. So this shows a schematic of crest type detector. The detector consists of a target crystal, which now is a scintillating crystal, and it has a superconducting thermometer, or a superconducting phase transition thermometer, or as people call it, TES, evaporated on the surface or glued on the surface. And we stabilize it somewhere in the middle of the transition from superconducting to normal conducting, where we get a relatively steep rise of resistance versus temperature. And that's where these tungsten thermometers are really sensitive thermometers. And we read them out with a squid-based readout circuit. And just to give you a feeling about the orders of magnitudes involved, the detectors are operated from somewhere between 10 and 20 millikelvin, depending on the individual operating temperature. They are all basically different because this is a very hard task to produce superconducting films with really identical transition curves. This we didn't manage up to now. So a typical width of a transition is, as you see here, is somehow millikelvin. And typical KeV signals, which we are looking for, are in the order of a few microkelvin. And to have stable, or let's say reproducible conditions, we have to run it always at the same point, because otherwise we would see different slopes of the transition curve and the gain of the system would change. So this tells us that we need a long-term stability of the order of microkelvin level, in the order of microkelvin level. And this we have to keep on time scales of 2 years, for example. So the advantage of this technique is that it allows to measure deposited energies independent of the interaction type. It just measures it colorimetrically. And it allows a low energy threshold and excellent energy resolution. And also different materials can be used. For example, in Quest 1, which is already a long time ago now, we were using sapphire crystals, which don't scintillate. So we had just one channel. But there we reached something like 100 eV energy resolution at low energies and an energy threshold of 600 eV in recoil energy, which is about a factor of 4 smaller than the present cogent sensitive or low energy threshold, because they usually give it in energy before applying the quenching factor. Okay, so in CREST 2, we combine this technique. So this is the crystal of the previous slide with its thermometer, with a light detector in the same scintillating reflecting housing. The light detector is also a cryogenic detector based on the same principle. It is actually a sapphire wafer with a thin monocrystalline silicon layer, which acts as a light absorber. So, as I said already before, the phonon channel measures the deposited energy with high precision independent of the interaction type. So this means we are not dependent, at least the energy channel does not depend on a quenching factor, which is the case, for example, for the liquid noble gas experiments. They are both channels depend, the signals on both channels depend on whether it's a nuclear recoil and then or a fully ionizing event. So you have to always apply a kind of a quenching factor. So as you see here on the right side, this is, for example, when we apply a neutron source, and if we apply a low energetic neutron source, this is a neutron source with something like 500 keV energy in the peak. Then we see, in addition to the, I forgot what I show here. Here I plot the signal which we see in this thermometer versus the signal seen in that thermometer, and in a scale when calibrated with a gamma source. So this means gammas and electrons show up in in a 45 degree, and oxygen recoils, this is the only thing which you can really make with such low energy neutrons, appear at a tenth of the light yield. The tungsten quenching factor is measured separately. All quenching factors are measured separately. And I mean, this is, maybe I come to that procedure, how we then define the bands, and this maybe will to some extent answer your question. Okay, I think I said. I forgot one thing, maybe. Here I wrote scintillating light reflector, and this is a very important point. We will find out. It's clear that we encase these both detectors with a reflector. This is just to get more light to the absorbed in the light detector. But it's also very important that it is scintillating, and this is important to for suppressing alpha-related backgrounds. For example, if an alpha decay would happen at the surface of this reflector, then there is a possibility that the alpha goes in the reflector and the nuclear recoil goes to the crystal, and this would be this is a severe background which cannot be distinguished from tungsten recoils because lead and tungsten are both heavy. But if this is scintillating, it's vetoed because we get then an additional light signal from the alpha particle hitting the scintillator, and this is pushed out of the nuclear recoil bands by this way. Okay, this shows this shows the layout or a picture of one of the detectors modules. This is the cylindrical calcium tungstate crystal. This is 4 centimeter in diameter and 4 centimeter high. This is the reflector. And here you see the thermometer structure. This is the light detector, which has also thermometer structure here shown very much enlarged. It's of course smaller. And both thermometers have an attached heater. I mean, this design is a bit hard to understand, so this I just say what it is. This small area here acts as an electrical heater. This also has a more simplified heater, and this is an important tool for us because this we use for bringing the detector into the operating point, and also we use it also for controlling the temperature and injecting test pulses, where we can see all the time how the detector can check the calibration all the time. So we know how well the detector is working. Okay, so this shows the kind of performance of the phonon channel we see at low energies and the quality of the energy calibration. For example, here I give just a few examples. The copper K alpha line, this guy here, we expect at 8.1, we find it at 8.2. So the calcium 41 here shows up, is expected at 3.61, we find it at 3.6. And the left shoulder of the lead 210 peak, has a strange structure because the lead 210 is incorporated in the crystal. So you get a superposition of the gamma line plus the beta spectrum. So the beta spectrum makes the right shoulder wider. And the left shoulder appears at 1/10 of a KeV wrong. So this tells you that we have a very precise energy calibration, and we have an energy resolution of something like 300 eV full width half maximum at low energies. This is one of the features which is at first glance not expected, that these detectors can at the same time also work at very high energies. So this is not a special run. So we measure all the time. We can measure up to 15 MeV if you want. And what we see is we get an enormous dynamic range and some very good linearity in a really wide energy range. And this, of course, allows a perfect discrimination of these beta gammas from alphas. And we can identify all these alpha lines in the crystal. By doing that, we have found some, it's already some time ago. Here you see this tungsten 180. This was before thought to be stable, and in fact it decays with a lifetime of some, if I remember right, 1.8 times 10 to the 18 years. Okay, this is a thing which is now special to a multi-target experiment. These are the three nuclei in our target, and here I show what fraction of the nuclear recoils are on which nuclei dependent on the wind mass. And you see at very low energies, due to kinematical reasons, it's only the oxygen region, the oxygen recoils, which make it above the threshold. At a little higher wind mass is around 10 GeV or a little bit above, the calcium becomes important, and slightly higher, the thing is totally dominated by tungsten recoils, simply due to the A square scaling, which is here assumed. Okay, this shows the crest setup. Now I have to move a bit closer. So what you see here from outside to inside is we have a 45 centimeter polyethylene shielding, which is used to moderate neutrons generated in the rock of Gran Sasso. And then the following thing, this blue structure, are muon veto panels. These are just 5 centimeters thick plastic panels, 24 panels, which surround the experimental volume as much as possible. Then the whole experiment, so the shielding is enclosed in a gas-tight radon box, which is flushed with nitrogen gas in order to prevent radon from going into the shielding. Yeah.
So is it not completely tight?
No. Here you see there is, for example, a small hole.
So what is
this? This means muons going in and going out are for sure seen, but there is a remote possibility that muons are stopped, and in this case we won't see them.
But they can induce neutrons, right?
Sorry, they can. Yeah, you will see. We have two events which point in this direction. Okay, then there is a 20 centimeter or at the thinnest. 20 centimeter of lead shield followed by some 14 centimeter of copper. And this is finally the cold box of the cryostat. So this is actually the place where the low temperature is created, and it's then guided around this lead in order to block the line of sight and brought into this box. And inside there, of course, is vacuum. Okay, let me come to the results from the present run. The cryostat is now cold, or the present run started in May 2009 and is running since then. And we have, out of the 17 detector modules mounted, 10 complete modules are operational deliver data. And in addition to SAM, we have 7 single channels running, and this sounds a bit stupid, but the reason is we have these 7 modules have light detectors, which didn't really make it into the transition. The transition temperature is just a bit too low for what the cryostat was actually able to reach. And so I mention it here because we will include them when we look for coincidences, which will turn out to be an important issue. So they can see coincidences, but they can't tell us what the detected particle was, but nevertheless it's useful. And we will also hear this word clamps. Maybe I should go back and show you what these clamps really are. So what we actually discuss a lot are these small spring-type objects, which are six in total, which hold the scintillating crystals. And they are made of a special alloy, which we made ourselves, of high purity copper and some 7/9 tin, which shouldn't contain lead, only less than 1 ppm. So it should be free of lead 210. This was the vision, the dream. And in this run, we didn't, in previous runs, we had these clamps coated with a plastic scintillator in order to have no non-scintillating volumes inside for the reasons of this alpha suppression. But the problem was plastics always tend to make some spontaneous relaxation processes, especially if plastic is under tension. And this delivers, when it happens close to the interface of the crystal, this delivers some energy to the crystal, which of course doesn't give light. And at lower enough energies, this is very similar to tungsten recoils, and we cannot recognize then whether it was this type of process or a tungsten recoil. Typical energies you will see then is the relevant energies for us are up to 40 kV. Yeah. But actually, these relaxation events can go up to 100 kV or so. I mean, they can deliver really high energies. And usually you can see them because they have, depending on where or at which distance to the point where it touches the crystal, it happens, you see some transport time. So this means the decay time of the pulses is a bit longer. But of course, for the signals of interest, which are usually always close to where you don't have a very good signal to noise, you are probably not able to for sure say that this is longer or not. So in order to avoid this unphysical background, we have not covered it with a scintillator. And you will see what we buy is some alpha background. OK, so now to finish this long story, the data analysis of this run is, as it is still taking data, is still in progress. And to that extent, the results are still preliminary. So what I will report are data with a net exposure of 564 kilogram days from these 9 calcium tungstate crystals. I mean, the zinc tungstate crystal I don't discuss. This is a little bit of special thing where we didn't have experience before, and it requires more attention. So what I discuss now is just the 9 calcium tungstate crystal. This data also include a neutron test in May, and also to really see the role or understand a bit more the role of neutrons coming from outside, we opened the neutron shield and recorded a while with open neutron shield. So this, I forgot to ask, how much time do I have? Okay, it's fine. Okay, this shows, I mentioned these test pulses, and here you see an example. We shoot various discrete energies all the time, and then we can see how the detector responds. We see the detector responds as a function of time to various energies, and this gives us the energy calibration at any time. And we see it's very relatively stable, or very stable actually. So this is something like 10 kV. No, this is 10 kV. Yeah. But we, for some reasons, because we want to understand structures higher up, we inject up to 2 MeV. And you see here how we achieve it. The trick is very simple, actually. What we do is we shoot a heater pulse, which is large enough to reach up to the top of the transition. And then this heater pulse simply measures the distance of the point where we operate to the top. And so if we keep this height constant in time, we keep the operating point constant. And so we shoot these so-called, in our language, called control pulses every 6 seconds. And then we know, and also in the data analysis, we look whether a data point lies between two of these control pulses, which really give a stable response and everything, and have the right timing, and only then we accept it as a true pulse. So this gives us a handle that we really only look to periods where the detector was really working the way it should. Okay, here this explains how we define the nuclear recoil acceptance band. At first, we make a fit, or let me say a word before. The width of this nuclear recoil band is given mostly by the resolution of the light detector, because simply the phonon detector is doing so much better that it almost doesn't enter. So with a fit to the gamma band, we determine the energy resolution of the light detector as a function of the deposited light energy. And then we only have to apply a quenching factor, and then we arrive at a prediction of the nuclear recoil band. And this is the nuclear recoil data plotted with the prediction of the acceptance band for oxygen recoils. No, this is mostly because you divide by energy. So I was a bit quick. I didn't say usually this is now a transition from, in the first plot I have shown, there was plotted energy in the light detector versus energy in the phonon channel. Now it's a ratio of light to phonon, and that's the division by zero makes it, or by almost zero, widens it so much. The resolution gets better, as you saw in the previous slide. The absolute resolution gets better the lower the energy is. Okay, and this is this is an example of another detector that you see that I didn't just show the best result. And here I've also shown what would be later on the energy range, which I will then call the signal energy range. So again, we see some.
Energy range?
We choose it, I will say it later, but I can also say it now. We choose it such that we get, we compute the whole running time that we have a gamma leakage of something like 0.1 per detector. And as you have seen, our gamma background isn't the greatest. This was the criterion why we chose it. And the 40 keV was chosen mostly because, let's see, if you look for oxygen recoils, this is what we are then doing, then if they are somehow related to WIMPs, then if you 40 keV is a good energy upper energy range, because if oxygen recoils would range much further up, then tungsten should become important, because then the WIMP is massive enough to give you tungsten recoils, which should then quickly dominate the whole scenario.
Could you put it up higher? Yeah. Introduce too much background?
No, this is there's another reason, but you are asking the questions which I would like to explain. But there is a second reason, of course. We try to keep it as low as possible, because there is a background source around 100 keV associated with these alphas, and we want to stay away from that. Okay, so this shows data of one single detector module. And the problem is a bit, we haven't found really a nice way or a convincing way how to plot several detectors on top of each other. The reason is because the width, you can do it for one single band, but if you want to consider three bands, as we do here, all detector modules have different energy resolutions of the light detector, unfortunately. And so this means that the width of the bands is different, and in, so it's, we have to really discuss data detector by detector. So what I show here is in yellow the band where we would expect alpha particles, and then this is where we would expect oxygen decoys, and in brown, which cannot be seen here. Here you see how it would really overlap with the it overlaps with the oxygen band at lowest energies. And what is clear from looking to the detectors that there are a number of unexpected oxygen recoils. This is something which we didn't believe at first glance, but it didn't go away, and more oxygen recoils came as a function of time. So I think we have to take it seriously. The problem is, I could show it, but if you see, the detectors aren't good enough for that, because the calcium band is between oxygen and tungsten, and I mean it's a matter of taste to see how separate it is. I mean, I agree with you in principle. In the analysis, we take it into account, of course.
Recoils could sometimes be caused by calcium recoils in reality. As you say,
there is a region, where, a small region where it wouldn't overlap. I mean, let's say something like this of the band, the upper part, is free of calcium. But, this is a weak point. We don't have a too good separation to calcium recoils. And to some extent, you can call the oxygen recoils maybe also calcium recoils.
So maybe it's a related question, but the uppermost events in red could be alphas.
Yes.
Right.
These things could be alphas.
Right, and the one below could be lead. Tungsten.
This one, which is shown in blue, could be tungsten. Yes.
Sorry, why are the other two not?
And this one.
Yeah.
So in principle, 1, 2, 3, 4 could be tungsten recoils. Okay, but we will address this issue. I agree. This is a bit. Okay, so let me now. It's clear there aren't only oxygen recoils on it, and this is the first thing. But in a way, one can understand all the structures seen. For example, in all detectors, and I will show you later on an even worse example where this is actually a bit stronger. I try to explain these two processes which I encircled here. So the first process is where we have an alpha emitter, for example, on the crystal. In this case, we can get the nuclear recoil. And if the alpha doesn't hit the scintillating foil, but, for example, the non-scintillating clamp, we get a nuclear recoil plus maybe a little bit of the alpha energy, because typically lead to 10 nuclei, which are the source of this polonium alpha decays, are implanted a little bit in the surface by previous alpha decays. So we get some 103 keV plus X. And this is seen here. We have some around 103 keV, plus, and something which this will go somehow in this direction, because you add basically dark energy to energy with a little bit of light, and this moves by this transformation, lets you move in this direction. There is another process, and which is the one which gives us a contamination in the tungsten band. It's this one, that, for example, this lead nucleus, this alpha decay happens at the non-scintillating clamp. Then we get the lead recoil, don't see the alpha, and the lead recoil can be at slightly lower energies because it lost part of its energy, and this is this structure. And so there's of course not a guarantee that this stops somewhere. I mean, this is has, for example, it can. There's no reason to assume that it stops. If you look to various detectors, you get the impression it may stop around 60 kV, but this may be simply a statistical issue. So this tells us that we cannot guarantee that this tungsten band is free of contamination. And that's why we will discuss, what I will discuss in the future is then only this part, which is shown here, which doesn't overlap with the tungsten band. And we will then present, make a background estimation of how many of these red dots here are maybe from alpha decays. This is, so here I summarized in the following, to be not influenced so much by the recoils in the tungsten band, we concentrate on signals, by the background in the tungsten band, we concentrate in, on signals in the upper part of the oxygen band, which does not overlap with the tungsten band. And if we do this for all the detectors, I've made here a little table, giving also these energies the energy range where we start up to 40 kV. And this counts the count seen in the tungsten band, seen in the overlap, seen in the oxygen band, and seen in the overlap free part of the oxygen band. Okay, in addition to these 32 events, we observed also two coincident events. Coincident means we have, in at least one detector, we have a recoil signal, an oxygen recoil signal seen in this red non-overlapping part, and other detectors seen something else. Yeah? This we define as coincident. And it's clear that such coincident events can only come from neutrons, because what else should make nuclear recoils? So this means we are then left with the possibility that these 32 events are from neutrons or caused by some leakage of alphas. And if we were able to really exclude this with high confidence, then we might talk about low mass WIMPs. So the next step will be we try to estimate how big these backgrounds can be, or should be, or we expect it to be. Okay, let me start with the difficult part. This is the neutrons. I mean, if we look, have a closer look to this observed two coincident events, we see that both of them are triple coincidences. So this means three cryogenic detector triggered simultaneously, one with a nuclear recoil in the right energy range, and one of the three detectors in these two events had always an MeV gamma quant. Okay, what I will now do is we can get a hold of the background in the single in the oxygen recoil single band, or let's say in the signal region, if we try to look how many singles we get for one coincidence. So this is the key for the neutron background estimation. And as you will see, there are two types of neutrons. One is, for example, something like neutrons coming from spontaneous fission or alpha N reactions in the rock of the laboratory. And they should be, in principle, and in the expectant, to be sufficiently shielded so that we don't see them. Another possibility would be some spontaneous fission of something of the uranium-thorium chain in the lead shield. But we have made some analysis, and this should also be much, much lower. So in principle, we wouldn't understand why we should have them, but nevertheless, we discuss them. So from that, we will see, we will mostly observe the coincidences will be mostly oxygen double scatters. And there are only a few triple coincidences and almost none with MeV gamma. So, as we will see, this or these things look very much unlike the two, doesn't resemble the two events which we have observed. On the other hand, we have muons. Their coincidences can have a different origin. I mean, in the coincidences in the first case are neutron goes from one detector to the next and scatters from this and that. And here you have a different mechanism. You create several or many neutrons in the shield, for example, by a muon. And then you have a coincidence because several detectors are hit either by gammas or muons from that shower. And this process will give us, as we will see, much higher multiplicities and also many more high energy gammas in the events. Okay, this is basically a repetition of what I said, but with the corresponding pictures. Here you see we made a neutron test that we put the neutron source outside the lead copper shielding on various places and measured the coincidence pattern. And so you see most of the events are just single oxygen recoils, and coincidences are mostly two coincidences, a few three, and no higher ones. And the single to coincidence ratio would be 3.4 for them, roughly. And as a rough estimate, these two corresponding, these two observed coincidences would then translate into seven oxygen recoils, which could be hidden under the 32 signal events.
Case with, or is energy dependent? Because I mean, here you probably have mono-energetic neutron source, right?
No, it's not mono-energetic. This was an americium beryllium source, which has a spectrum up to over 10 MeV. So the peak is at 2 MeV, but it has a couple of structures which give very high energies. But the trick is the lead shield in particular. Lead is depending, there are several isotopes and they have, let's say, at 600-700 keV cross sections which rise by 10 orders of magnitude. And so this means this lead doesn't let pass energetic neutrons. So they multiply in the lead, and what you have inside is always the same source of neutrons, independent of on what you apply outside.
So how do you know that your spontaneous fission events don't contain gammas?
Just by looking.
So that's not, we check.
Actually, what we do later on, this is more now just the qualitative motivation. What we do, actually, we look to the multiplicity and the gamma content of the coincident event. So we look which fraction of the energy is in gammas. This is one parameter later on. And what is the multiplicity and what is the corresponding multiplicity to single ratio. This is what finally enters in the analysis.
But this is from neutron.
Yeah, in this case, you just have to believe me. This is not reflected in this graph. I just say by words, we find very few. So I think something in the whole sample, there are two MeV gammas involved. Okay, and none with that high energies, because one of these energies is 1.8 MeV gamma, and the other one is 1.2 MeV, so this is really high energy.
So these gammas come from the fact that they excite some nucleus?
Now the point is why you don't, at first I thought it's very clear you should expect MeV gammas from neutrons, because you have capture reactions. But the point is capturing happens only when the neutrons are very slow. So this means there's nothing which slows them down in the inside. So in order to slow down, they somehow has to go outside to the polyethylene, become thermal or nearly thermalized, and then they can be captured. But then the chance that this neutron goes back is, or this gamma is detected is zero. This is the reason why you see very, very few MeV gammas from neutron capture. In these coincidences, I think at least. And this shows the situation for muon-induced neutrons, muon-induced oxygen recoils. And these are just, we have something, I forgot the exact number, but I just would have to sum up. I think it's, what is the same? 32 or 36 events are packed by the neuron
beta, which have at least one recoil in the signal energy range. And this shows the multiplicity pattern of these events, and it's obvious we see much higher multiplicities and also sometimes several gammas involved, included in the event. And the fundamental difference is that these neutrons give us only a single true coincident if we take them as a rough measure. Later on, we will, of course, take the individual translation number. Gives us roughly something like 0.32 single true coincident. This means from the two observed coincident events, we would just predict something like less than one event in the signal energy range. Okay, to get an idea, a further handle on how important could be neutron background from spontaneous fission or alpha N leaking, let's say, through some small gaps in the neutron shield. We opened the neutron shield, two sides of it, and measured how the rate changes. And what we got is when we had two sides open, we just measured a doubling of the rate. So this means we get roughly the rate of signal events when we have the neutron shield two of the largest walls open. So I think this clearly tells that a leakage through some tiny holes of the neutron shield can certainly not be the reason for this 32 events. Okay, let me now come, I have to speed up a bit. Let me now come to the explanation of this alpha background. Here I've shown a detector a bit in a wider energy range. You see here some, for us, very typical line, the samarium line and the tungsten 180 line. These are contaminations, or these are in the crystal, and then we see this continuous band. And this is the degraded alphas, which are emitted from these clamps, and they are, since they have to go out of this clamp, they have a continuum which goes down to the energies. There is also a structure. These are the nuclear recoils vetoed by the scintillating foil. And these are, for example, these are events, this cloud of events, these are nuclear recoils where the alpha emitter was a little bit deeper implanted. And then we see in the crystal the nuclear recoil energy plus the 70 keV or 80 keV of light by the foil, offset by the foil, plus the energy deposited by the alpha in the crystal. So this gives this mess above the line. And so we try to understand here is now again in the yellow band, this would be the low energy part of the structure which you saw before, which this is, to really show it, this is the detector with the worst alpha background. And you see it has many more structures here around just to demonstrate the effect. So what we do is we pick a region where as close as possible to the signal energy range of the alpha band and extend it a little bit above to have some statistics, and then we count the events in this upper part of the alpha band, and then finally we project or we compute the expectation from these counts in this region, assuming a constant energy density. And I mean, at least for the higher energies, this is a reasonable extrapolation. And also, if you do a Monte Carlo simulation of the stopping of these alphas, it seems a constant density in such a small range seems to be a reasonable assumption. Okay, if you do all that, this is then what we obtain. We get something like 32 events. Okay, I have to say this is now the result of a likelihood analysis where we put all these additional measurements like the counts of the alphas in the reference region the measured coincidences, the coincidence pattern of the muons, the coincidence pattern of the neutrons, the gamma content of the events. This is all put into it. And then this is the best fit what you get for the backgrounds, for the various backgrounds. So in total, there's a remaining, there are something like 23 signals remaining, which cannot be explained by that type of background. In order to understand how significant this is, one can make a likelihood ratio test where you ask, where you force the signal to zero and check how much the likelihood ratio rises. And if you do that and assume that the coincident events are of muon-induced type, which I think is the very likely possibility, in this case, one gets 5.4 sigma of the signal. So this means the significance of the signal would then be 5.4 sigma. If, on the other hand, you say we should at least allow for neutrons of source type, who knows? In this case, if you do that, the significance goes down to 2.7. So in any case, and I would say it is, whatever is realized, it is interesting. And I think we should confirm this in a
new run where we get rid of these backgrounds, for example, of these alpha backgrounds and also of the gamma backgrounds, and really see whether this oxygen recoils survive in a clean situation. This is what we are our plans for the next future. Okay. Let me come to inelastic dark matter for the moment. I mean, as I said, the tungsten band is probably contaminated by lead recoils, but nevertheless, since the tungsten nucleus is a rather heavy crust, can give the strongest constraints on inelastic dark matter. So this shows the region expected from Dana when. I should say it differently. This is the mass splitting for various mass splitting,
and this is roughly the relevant range needed for explaining the Dama experiment roughly. And in this case, this is the 90% and the 3 sigma contour of the Dama experiment, and this is what we get from the present run. So at least in this. Let's say in this conventional scenario where we assume standard Halo parameters, I think we can say the inelastic dark matter scenario is roughly excluded. Okay. So the first point I said already. So if this alpha estimate is roughly okay and if there are no unexpected surprises, this is alpha-related recoil backgrounds. I mean, there is a clear excess of oxygen recoil signals. A new run with strongly reduced alpha background is the next logical step. It should allow to pin down the nature of the observed oxygen recoils with high confidence, and I didn't explain this next point, and also constrain the neutron background with higher significance. So we also plan to replace the light detectors which have now a too low transition so that we can, instead of having 9 modules delivering data, have 17. So we should get more exposure and a better, higher coincidence to signal ratio in the next run. So, and if the signal, this just repeats. I mean, another option which we have for the more, I mean, if this really persists, the hints for the light mass WIMP scenario become stronger and stronger, I think we could go for a next step with the present crest setup. We could increase the volume of the present cold box and still keep the shielding by some factor of 3, which would finally roughly allow to increase the mass up to a factor of something like 10 to the present thing. So this is what we could do without doing too much to the present setup, and could be maybe realized within a few years or 3 years. Okay, another option is, which we are investigating, there are of course much better targets for light mass wimps, something like sapphire. And sapphire can be a very good scintillator, but it's, we are looking at it as a potential absorber since a long time. And the only problem which we are still faced is it's very hard to control a good light output. So there's a large variation from crystal to crystal, and it is very difficult to get a relatively high light output as a standard for any crystal you get. So I hope we get this under control, and then sapphire would be really a good target for light mass wimps. Okay, so thank you very much.
Well, we started 10 minutes late, so we have time for questions. Sorry.
Has anybody tried to fit this to light dark matter?
Yeah. I mean, to fit?
Of course.
I don't show this plot mostly for several reasons.
You have the plot?
Yeah, I have the plot, yeah.
Oh, come on, show it.
No, I can't say, I don't, actually, I haven't appended to it. I can tell you. It's
like,
so it's around 12 GeV. And the cross section is around 5 times 10 to the minus 5 picopoints. So I always think in picopoints, I have to translate it into square centimeters.
10 to the minus 41.
This means it's a bit on the high mass side of presently hot zone. But to be really honest, I mean...
You mean for the hot zone for the other experiments?
Yes. Gamma and quotient. And the reason is we have very little handle on, or let's say, a limit how high the wind mass can be would mostly come from the onset of calcium and tungsten. And since we have this contamination in the tungsten band, we didn't include it, and therefore this is a bit relatively open for towards higher masses. So I think to really constrain the wind mass very much, one needs the tungsten band, and then I would say if there are clean situations, one could very, very much fix the wind mass, because it's clear if it's much higher than 10 GeV, tungsten should rise a lot. Okay.
So you had a problem with the energy spectrum, but you
sort
of went very quickly.
Yeah, I went over very quickly.
So if you want to ignore the question, you can ignore it.
No, I can show it.
But
first of all, it's a bad plot, which I made a mistake. I inversed the colors in order to make it visible, but achieved the opposite.
But
so what you see is it's difficult to understand. So this is the background estimate. I mean, the best fit case, not this is, now it becomes a bit difficult. I mean, this likelihood analysis which I showed you was mostly to say whether an excess of the oxygen recoils is statistically significant. But it didn't answer the question whether the excess has the shape of a wimp spectrum. And this would change the answer slightly and also give different parameters, of course. So this is simply what you would get plugging in the estimated background parameters which I have shown you, and this gives you that thing. And this rises here. And what you expect is it should fall. Yeah? Mostly, this is mostly the alpha background. Yeah? It should fall because you have a decreasing overlap in this trend you see here. And this structure comes because the length of the various thresholds of the detectors. And this yellow curve is just would be a 12 GeV. seen weightedness with the exposure of the various detectors and the acceptance of the various detectors. And this thing is the sun. And you clearly see there is kind of a, it looks that there is a higher background here. Of course, but this is only the best fit value in that case. I mean, nothing prevents it from rising up here. So, I mean, there is of course, one has to see this is one count, two counts. This is always a bit problem. But I admit, it's...
Well, I guess the question is, if you integrate from, like, let's say, 25 to 40, you have something like 12, 13 counts, but I don't think that curve will integrate to 12 counts. So your background, your alpha background, if you integrate, like, the area under the curve, but only from 25 to 40.
Yeah, this should give 6 counts.
Right, and you have many more than 6 counts.
No, it's 0.5.
No. In the you actually observe many more than 6 counts, right? Above 0.5.
No. Okay, to be honest, there is this, what is all is 0.8 neutrons expected plus 6 and whatever. Okay, I'll show you the number once again. No, that was too far. Ah, yeah. 6.8 and 0.8, and what I neglected is 1.2 gamma leakage. So you might ask why it's not 0.9, but this is okay.
No, I'm perfectly happy with that. But you have events which you don't understand at higher energies.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. Like the number of events there is something like order 13 or 14.
Yeah.
And so even if you subtract the alpha background, which is like, let's say, 8, okay, you're left with like order 8 events in that region, which are unexplained. But it's hard to believe that a WIMP at 12 GeV can explain.
Yes, but let's say like this. This is the best fit under the assumption that you don't assume anything on the signal trail. And I mean, if you go to that level that you say, let's say, force the signal to zero, I don't recall the numbers, but then you probably have something like 12, 13 counts here. I mean, this is a number. This is under the assumption that we, how do I say, this is the best fit, not assuming any signal shape within the oxygen recoil band. But I agree, it's a situation, I don't want to talk it nice, the situation looks like that there is an unaccounted background at the, and I think just a few counts are enough to spoil the fit in that thing, but nevertheless, this hasn't really started. We will look in an analysis where we put the proper pulse, the shape of the expected signal in, and try to do the same likelihood analysis under that assumption. But, yeah, I mean, I would come back to my previous statement. To really be convinced it's obvious one has to get rid of that background, then the discussion is a lot easier, of course.
How do your new scintillating clamps work? Because you had this discussion about when you put plastic on, what the problems of that. Your new clamps? What is new about the
okay,
new
so what we agreed on that we don't want to have plastic in contact with the crystal. So what we are doing now is we have basically a very similar metal clamp, shape-wise. But this clamp then receives a small, kind of a hole. And in this hole sits a calcium tungstate ball. You can make very nice calcium tungstate balls, let's say 2 millimeter diameter. So we asked a company which normally makes bearings out of sapphire balls, for high-speed bearings. And they managed to make high-quality calcium tungstate balls. So we place a ball there, which is then the medium in contact with the crystal. This is glued to the clamp then. And then the clamp can be coated, or will be coated with a plastic scintillator. And in this case, if relaxation happens, the energy will be delivered to the gland and not via the hope. This is the hope, not via the small area, which the small contact area of the ball with the crystal. So in this way, the relaxation events will still happen, but not deliver a visible energy. And this is what we think.
So this has already been done, and you're just running now
faster. We have a test setup at Gran Sasso, so a second cryostat which was built up last year to test such issues, because I mean usually you learn it only if you do it, put it in, and then after 1 year of work you say, oh shit. And so the very rough mistakes we can see with this test cryostat, and there is now a test in progress which tests exactly these clamps. And I think we will learn at least whether, I mean, the danger is always, I don't want to go into too deep details. The point is you would like to keep this crystal as strong as possible, because this gives you a good behavior for microphonics, which is usually our worst enemy. Because when the crystal moves, it produces heat at the interface, and this disturbs the baseline. So if you keep it strong, then it doesn't move, you don't get this problem. But if you keep it too strong, you might exert too much pressure and the crystal might break, and you get some signals which are due to breaking of the crystal and have nothing to do. So this is a very fine balance you have to make. But I hope you achieve it.
So are you going to be doing just your completely new setup going forward, or are you actually going to
be doing... No, this is just what we do, is we get the detectors home to Munich. We'll remove them from the housing, put new clamps, rebond them, put them back, and...
Everything else stays the same.
Yeah, okay. Everything else stays the same. So this should be the time scale expected for this. The present plan is that we cool down around May next year. So we warm up in December, get detectors in January, and the preparations are of course running since some time. Yeah, so if we are lucky, we get already an answer, I would say, at the end of next year, we should definitely have it.
So are you going to put in this new sapphire crystal?
No, this is too early. This was the mid-term option. So there were two lines in the conclusion. The short-term option is just keeping present detectors, put like detectors at the position of the ones which have a two-level transition, and replace the clamps.
So can you maybe say a short word about your zinc tungstate crystal?
Yes, the zinc tungstate is a new material, which by the way was introduced by Reno. And the trick why we liked it a lot is because it doesn't contain calcium. Most of the radioactivity in these crystals comes via the calcium. This is homologous to strontium. So this gives us the low energy background, and also it tends to contain lots of uranium and thorium. So usually we know this since years, calcium is the enemy, and this is very difficult to improve. And zinc tungstate gives a higher light yield and has much lower background, a sinking factor of 5 or so.
But do you see oxygen records?
Yes, we see everything very nicely. The only problem we have in the moment is it has a surface problem. So this means a very, very thin layer of the surface of the crystal delivers less light. And this we see the high energy alphas coming from outside. They are degraded alphas, which still have roughly their correct energy, but we see them at a slightly lower energy, slightly lower light energy. But if we go lower to energy like this samarium line, which is only a 2 MeV alpha, we see that this light output goes down much more. So this means any depth probed between these high energy alphas and the low energy ones, there is a layer which delivers less light. So it's probably less than 10 micron thick. And this can be connected with the heat treatment of the crystal, which is usually done in order to stabilize the light output and stabilize the oxygen content. And probably there was it was met. Yeah, this is probably something one must avoid. This is my guess. Probably some zinc goes out or whatever. It's not really clearly understood. But we will investigate this. But for the next run, I would say zinc tungsten, this is too quick to make it an option. We will investigate this problem in a laboratory experiment in Munich. And then when we understand it, this is of course still a good candidate.
The second thing in yellow confuses me, because it says you don't expect any,
yeah,
and then it says you can nevertheless include them,
yeah,
but yet you don't expect any, so it shouldn't have any effect. And then it has this huge effect on the likelihood ratio.
So this confuses me. Yeah, but this one can easily understand. I give you an example which makes it clear.
Okay.
If you forget this likelihood ratio analysis, but just simply think you haven't observed any neutrons of source type, yeah? But never, or any coincidences due to neutrons of source type, but not having anything observed means at 90% upper confidence level something like 2.3. So not observe anything means upper level is 2.3. And then this multiplies, this comes in with the ratio seen for them, even if you have not the slightest idea where they should come from. If you include it, they are there, even if they are not seen there. And they have this huge effect.
You planning to look for time dependence in the future?
Yeah, 32 events are a bit on the low side. But it's let's say it like this. I mean, if you can blow this up by a factor of 10, it's like completely ridiculous. So, of course, what would always be very nice if one could go for improve on sensitivity, this would be the most. I mean, it's not sensitivity, so where we trigger is something like 2 kV, so the trigger threshold is not the problem, but the problem is where really good separation sets in between gammas, and or where it is good enough that you completely avoid leakage.
That was basically a year of running, those 32 events? Or?
Yeah, something like a year of running time. I mean, 560 kilogram days, I mean, it's, I cannot really say it in percent of the data being analyzed, but let's say 60-70% of the data analyzed.
So you could make 6 month bins where we're moving in,
yeah,
and out.
Of course, in principle, it's clear. Not month bins, this is clear, but one could do something like that.
Well, I mean, square root of 32 is pretty large, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say when normally one thinks one needs a couple of hundred in order to think about seeing something, some really large motivation. So I would say that this threshold would be something which we are, of course, always working on, which could help a lot. I mean, if you can push the threshold down by a factor of 2 or higher, this would be a tremendous gain. I mean, we have two options for that, doing that. One which might come on a shorter term, maybe even for the next run, is the light detector which we are using now has something like 70% absorption for the blue light. And using a silicon wafer where you deposit some nanoparticles of gold, and then this act as an etching catalyst, and then you etch hole in the silicon crystals where these particles were, and then this gives you more or less a continuous variation of the index of refraction, and the net effect is that the thing looks black. So it's if it's suitable, this we don't yet know for making or if it doesn't degrade the phonons, the frequency spectrum of the phonons, then this might be a good step. So measured absorptions are something like above 99%. So this could be a good step. The second thing is, which might be an even larger step, is we have looked into some strange crystal, cesium iodide, which is of course a well-known thing, non-dope.
Well, it scintillates with dope.
No, it scintillates also. It scintillates even
better. Oh, without the cesium?
Yeah, cesium iodide. When it's not though, it scintillates much better. It gives a factor of 7 more light. So we have measured this recently. We converted a cesium iodide crystal into a cryogenic detector. And this delivers 7 times more light. So this would, if we were able to implement it really and have no problems with it, this could push down the threshold by a factor of 7. So this would be, this would be of course a dream. This would. But of course, this is, we are very few people, and in the moment R&D is kind of small because we have to get preparations for the neuron done, and this keeps a few people busy. So CREST is not really a big experiment. It's, let's say, if you have, what will you say?
40.
Yeah, but the active groups, which, let's say, if it's 10 people who really work, I think then this is pretty good. Okay.
Sure, last question.
Ja, zu.